T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's gonna go! Alvarez ties the game!
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
The Dan Bernstein Show. Weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
A lot happening in our world. Doing our best to handle it as best we can as things are moving fast and statements are coming out from teams, from athletes, from coaches, and we're understanding where people stand. And I think it's a critical time because we're going to remember. This is a time for people to define themselves. This is a time for people to show us who they are and of what they are made. Let's talk now with Dave Zirin, who recently had a conversation with one of the smarter people in sports. Dave Zirin is one of those, at Edge of Sports on Twitter, sports editor at The Nation, host of the Edge of Sports podcast. He's on the Alpamonte Ford hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. How are you hanging in, Dave?
Hanging in. I'm calling you from D.C., so things haven't exactly been quiet here by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, trying to just keep my family's mental in one piece at this point because my kids are just not understanding what this country has become.
How old are your kids?
They're 15 and 12.
Yeah, I've got a 15-year-old as well who is, we're asking a lot of questions and we're trying to answer a lot of questions as honestly as we can. My 18-year-old about to head off to college is, thinking of having some different conversations as well. But it's probably our biggest responsibility right now is to be as honest as we can, right? And share our own fears and not try to mask anything and not try to pretend we're something we're not.
Oh, no, I'm being as real as possible with them because I'm trying to prepare them for the future. And I don't care if that future is dark. It's my first obligation as a parent to prepare them for that by all means necessary.
Now, I'm glad you picked up the phone and called Greg Popovich because wow. That was we know how he's felt in the past, but to hear him burning with such righteous fury was what I needed. I mean, I imagine the phone was just shaking as he was talking.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, he called me. I didn't call Pop. He called me. It was about midnight. And he just, you know, started with some, you know, pleasantries, wanted to make sure the families were okay, both in terms of COVID and in terms of what's been happening in D.C. And then he just said, I've got some things I really need to say. And then he just started, he just went into it. I mean, he's been critical of Trump before, no question about it. He's been critical of racism before, no question about it. But the way he synthesized his thoughts, the way he spoke about this being deeper than just a Donald Trump issue. But this was, I thought, so critical about his comments, about why they're important, not just because they're Greg Popovich's comments. He said, yes, this is a systemic problem. It's much deeper than Donald Trump. But at the same time, we have such a malignant crisis of leadership in this country that the way we get out of this systemic problem is not apparent to any of us. And I think that's a very important point to make because we have to think of this on those two fronts. We have a lot. We have problems that go back way before 2016, but we're not in any way, shape, or form equipped to face those problems because of this presence in the White House. That was Greg Popovich's main point, and I think he made that crystal clear. It's also very interesting what he said because, as I'm sure you know, the San Antonio Spurs are one of only two teams in the entire NBA, along with the Knicks, who haven't really said anything so far. And so to have the Spurs as an organization say nothing, not even the most antiseptic comments about what's taking place, And yet to have Greg Popovich come out filled with so much fire is a very interesting contrast between the ownership of the Spurs, which has changed in recent years because of a divorce in the Holt family, and Greg Popovich. And I wonder where that's going to lead in terms of the future of the team, quite frankly.
The NBA, as it has in the past, is leading again. These coaches, whether it has been the consistent voices of Steve Kerr, of Stan Van Gundy, of Greg Popovich, and others, the Doc Rivers statement that we put out, as we, I don't want to say grading, but there is a scale on which you can understand the difference between a corporatized branding or a planting of the flag relative to an issue and something that's genuine and heartfelt and aware and real. I applaud the NBA on so many levels for being out ahead of this. And it's my hope that some of these other tighter-assed leagues might understand that it's okay to be like this.
Yeah, and the NBA is ahead on a very important historical front, too. And maybe this all stems from the fact that former NBA player Steven Jackson was very good friends with George Floyd. They called each other twin, of course, because they look so similar. Maybe that's the reason. But you've seen numerous NBA players, high-profile NBA players, at protests, at peaceful demonstrations, whether you're talking about Marcus Smart, whether you're talking about Jaylen Brown, Enes Kanter, whether you're talking, I think, very significantly about former NBA player Royce White, who I interviewed, who's been leading thousands of people in Minneapolis, St. Paul on demonstrations, getting very little publicity that this former NBA player has such a leadership role in the community. I mean, Karl Anthony Towns, just 2 months after his mother dies from COVID, is out there in a mask. And that's very significant because it shows it's not just, you know, talk from behind a gated community, but that there's an actual connection to the people who are trying to resist what's happening, to people who are fighting for meaningful reforms. And it's also significant because very famously in the late 1960s, particularly after Dr. King's assassination, athletes, particularly black athletes, were often mobilized to quell protests, to calm people down, to really go out at the behest of the city. And this is a very different dynamic that we're seeing in 2020.
The Royce White involvement is fascinating to me, and I think the most complete telling of his story that I saw was on HBO's Real Sports, and talking mm-hmm. about his battle with the league and teams to understand his anxiety and understand what he was dealing with. And this could end up being a remarkable total tale, seeing what he is feeling compelled to do.
Absolutely. For folks who don't know, I mean, Royce White is not in the NBA, not because he can't play. He was an All-American at Iowa State. He's not in the NBA because of real debates with Adam Silver about mental health in the NBA and whether or not they can provide for people who deal with depression or deal with anxiety. And that's why he's not in the league, because they wouldn't accommodate his particular mental health needs. But one of the things that Royce White's been arguing all along is that mental health is not just an issue for him, is that there, particularly in the black community, particularly in poor communities, there are serious problems with depression, anxiety, that are going utterly unconfronted. And I think you're seeing the fruits of that right now. That, you know, there people are just broken. And some of that, of course, is COVID. Some of that is having a quarter of the country out of work. And some of it is also seeing the injustices of the killing of George Floyd and now the killing of other protesters as well. But people are broken. I spoke this morning to a community leader out in Minneapolis, and he said, right now, our number one job is trying to control what's happening, to try to guide it. And it's incredibly hard because people themselves are so broken, are so separated from where they think this country is supposed to be. They feel outside the United States while living inside the United States.
what are the concrete next steps you think are important to see in sports? We have heard teams and players, consortiums of coaches come up with ideas of reaching out to communities, but there has to be more that can be done for actual policy rather than just a mouse click of $50 that goes into a fund to help this or that. When and how can athletes and coaches best affect change?
Well, I feel like the athletes have stepped up, and it's just like, keep doing what you're doing, please, because we've never seen an outpouring from athletes like this. I think, though, at the level of ownership, at the level of the commissioners of the sports, I mean, they need to be putting where their money, where their mouth is, and not in ways, like you said, of $50 at a time, but I'm talking hundreds of millions of dollars at a time, because one of the problems is that over the last generation, stadium funding has replaced anything resembling a real urban policy in this country. And our cities have been hollowed out. And these stadiums are, in many respects, monuments to that. And I think it's time they've taken a great deal over the last 30 years with these stadiums. And I think it's time for them to give back, to recognize their accountability and responsibility to the cities that they call home. More than just photo ops, more than just NBA cares, but real cash.
There's a terrific column from Mike Jones of USA Today, and he talks to Anquan Boldin. Anquan Boldin, who lost his cousin at the hands of a white police officer who had found him at the side of the road when his car was broken down. And it's a very personal cause to Anquan Boldin. And I thought he made a really good point, too. And especially today, when many states are going to the polls today for primaries, for some localized elections, some grassroots level stuff. His point being that know what your elected officials, what your attorney general or your DAs, your people in charge of the law, what their policy is on punishing bad actors in law enforcement. Those who maybe in Georgia say, well, I don't know, I'll let a grand jury decide, aren't the same as someone who is going to say, I will aggressively prosecute bad actors in law enforcement. That's what he is saying. And it hits home today because of so many localized elections. And I keep thinking that's that level of education and that level of understanding and actually demanding to know the specific policies of the people in charge of bringing the bad actors to justice is something on which we can also focus.
Yeah, I think that's very smart. We need an educated populace that's going to the polls and voting. But a couple of the problems there is, you know, for example, my wife teaches in DC high school. She teaches social studies. Classes like government, classes like citizenship, classes like social studies are the ones that are being slashed and attacked. The class sizes are too big. We're not educating that generation at all in our school system. They're the casualty of cuts. And also, when you have this level of unemployment, when you have the absence of an industrial workforce in the cities, when that's been hollowed out, it's also very, very difficult historically to have that voting populace that is engaged and connected and feels a sense of ownership in the process. Because that's the problem right now. People don't feel a sense of ownership of their neighborhoods that are rapidly gentrifying. They don't feel a sense of ownership, certainly of the police who are supposed to be there to serve and protect. We have a situation where we have colonies within the nation, to use the words of W.E.B. Du Bois. And until we confront that, it's going to be very, very difficult to make the voting piece work.
We're talking with Dave Zirin of The Nation and the Edge of Sports podcast. Last thing for you, Wes Unseld passed away today. And I'm wondering what the effect of that is and what he has meant to D.C. as a towering figure in basketball.
I'm in D.C., as you said. I mean, there are no words for it. Wes Unseld, Rookie of the Year and MVP, a champion. We haven't had a champion in D.C. basketball at the NBA level since the 1970s. Those are Wes Unseld's teams that won those championships. He was a GM and a coach of the Washington. Then they were called the Bullets. He's always been a part of the franchise. He's always been a part of the city. And he's always represented kind of the broad-shouldered toughness of a city that is so much more than just the government and Capitol Hill. Wes Unseld, I mean, to lose him at this time when all this is happening in the city, it is like salt in the wounds because of what he's meant.
I always tell people that the all I needed to know about Wes Unseld was the stuff that I used to hear from both Doug Buffone and Norm Van Leer. Doug Buffone, who knew him in college at Louisville, and Van Leer, who played against him. And those two guys, like, that was reverent tones from two friends of mine and athletes themselves, professional athletes of unquestioned toughness. And when they talked about him, it was genuinely reverent. He clearly was not just some guy.
Can I tell you just real quick? I know we're short on time, but when I was a young buck here, I asked Wes Unseld a question. He was in the front office at the time, and he said to me, "I'll answer your question if you tuck in your shirt." And so no one's ever said that to me before. And as you probably know, us sports reporters are not exactly always a fastidious group of people. So I never even thought about it. And then I looked at him, and he was dressed, you know, he was in his suit, and he expected a similar level of professionalism from me. And after I tucked in my shirt, he was awesome. Oh, by the way, you better believe I tucked in my shirt.
Wow, that's great.
One look from Wes Unseld, I wasn't gonna disobey anything he was trying to say to me.
Yeah, you compare that to what Matt Patricia did. Remember when he said, "Could you have some respect here? Could you just sit up?" You know, it's sort of the way it's done. I think you know if a guy's got genuine gravitas when you snap to action and say, "Yes, sir."
Exactly. Except Matt Patricia's been pulling food out of his beard, and he's not the best messenger for that kind of approach.
Dave, thanks for all the great work, and thanks for taking time for us today.
No, thank you.
That is Dave Zirin, Edge of Sports, the sports editor of The Nation on Sports Radio 670 The Score. When we come back, I want to get you updated on what's going on with baseball, because it does seem, and we can get into some of the details of it, but it does seem that baseball has caved on at least how they're going to pay the players, that there is going to be, they're going to stick with the memorandum of understanding from March about the prorated money, but now they're just going to argue about the number of games that are going to be played that will allow for that prorated money to be played. I do think it's an acrimonious step in the right direction. John Heyman, Radio.com MLB Insider, was on with Molly and Haw earlier, and he's got all the latest coming up next on The Score.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify is got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
It is a very hot day in Chicago, going up to 92 degrees, I saw today. Well, so much for spring, we're right into summer. Okay, that's pretty cool then, I guess. Try to get outside, take a walk. It's good for you. Try to breathe a little bit. The lilacs are blooming, my favorite time of year. So and try to enjoy some of that. It's okay. You don't have to feel guilty, and it's probably good for you. Earlier this morning, Radio.com Sports MLB insider John Heyman was on with Mully and Haw, and he's got all the details of what's going on, where they are in this acrimonious negotiation to restart their season. But he started out by talking about the lack of response, in large part, from baseball owners to the murder of George Floyd at the hands of a white Minneapolis cop.
Obviously, the NBA does fantastic with social issues, and you hear Popovich popping off, no pun intended, and talking about the situation, and other people in basketball talking about it. The NFL made a statement, and of course they were shot down because they have been poor on social issues, at least in my opinion. So I don't think it's because the MLB is gun-shy. I think probably that they're working on negotiation and right. And worried about getting the season going and their own business. But, yeah, it might be nice to see a little more commentary from MLB.
John, what is going on with the negotiations between the owners and players? It seems like, you know, it's almost funny if you think about it. Hey, let's have an 82-game season, but we don't want to pay you. We'll go 114. We'll give you 50. Let's meet in the middle. I think that's 82. I don't know if they're going to meet in the middle, if they're going to offer the 50, 60-game season, if they're going to settle at 82. What the heck's going on?
Okay, first of all, let me say that I do think we will have an agreement at some point here, and we will have a season. I can't believe, and I'm just doing this based on my belief, I just know that both sides know that there is way too much to lose to blow this up over money. And the fans forgave last time, eventually, after the 94 lockout strike, whatever you want to call it, work stoppage. I'm not sure they'd be forgiving this time. It would not make any sense to do this during a pandemic. They have to figure it out. So I see people writing there will be a season. I think they're taking a little bit of a chance. I do think there will be a season. That said, things are not going well in the negotiations. As you alluded to, MLB made a proposal with some drastic cuts on the expensive players, on the high salary players, the star players. And then the players came back and actually moved the ball in the other direction and asked for more games and all the prorated pay and all that. So both sides were very unhappy with the other side's first offer. That said, it's the first offer. I will point out that the soft deadline for a deal, which was yesterday, is already in the rearview mirror. So the time is short. There is no hard deadline yet, but presumably, it's got to be around June 10th because that's when you wanted to start this spring training for a July 4th start of the season. So right now, we're getting off to an extremely, extremely slow start.
John, Rob Manfred has an obligation or maybe a right to deliver a season, a schedule. I think the language says calls for it in good faith because – to give it some legitimacy. And I think when everybody was concerned about the health and safety issues as the primary potential obstacle in the way of getting that season underway, you felt like, okay, 50 games, whatever they need to do, as long as they crown a champion, we'll feel good about it. Now it feels like a financial move, like, okay, there are financial considerations why it would be 50 games, and it would seem to kind of lessen the legitimacy of a champion if you can play 82 games or if you can play 100 and people are willing to accept the health and safety risks that are inherent in that. So where do they meet in the middle? Is it back to an 82 game season? Because how does this 50 game proposal strike you? Do you think that it would be a legitimate season?
Yeah, I mean, very good question, David. First of all, the report of the 50-game proposal was a bit of an exaggeration. There actually is not a proposal of 50 games. Right now we just stand with the owners offering the 82 games with pay cuts and the players asking for 114 games with the prorated pay that is mentioned but not guaranteed in the March 26th agreement. That came out, the 50 game, as we have come to call it from yesterday's proposal. It's not a proposal. It's just the noting of the owner's side that Rob Manfred has the ability, based on that agreement, to start a season of any length at prorated. So he could do that, but that's more of a tactic, a negotiating tactic at this time. I'm not sure it's going to mean anything. He's not going to do that. You know, maybe 10 days from now, he might consider it more seriously, but I think that's just to point out to the players that he can do this. That would just start a war if he did that, to say we're going to play 50 games and that's all you're going to get paid. MLB wants to negotiate a deal. They want the players to be happy with the deal. And, you know, so the negotiation continues. There isn't that proposal. Two reasons that wouldn't fly is, you're right, the legitimacy would be questioned. But the bigger reason is the players would be so upset. They not only have a dispute, they'd actually be at war with the MLB at that point.
John, you know, I don't want to accuse the Ricketts of putting on the poor mouth, which is an Irish expression for exaggerating the direness of your situation, especially financial. But it seemed like Scott Boras took specific aim at the Cubs when he sent out that email to all of his clients. And the idea being that they've been one of the more vocal teams, at least until that moment, talking about the amount of money that they were losing on a day-to-day basis. And he tried to point out that they own all this property around Wrigley and they have all this other money that they've made. And, you know, Major League Baseball owners have made all this money over the course of, I think it is 17 consecutive seasons where there has been money coming in. Do the owners control the message to a point where they can look like they're negotiating in good faith when they're really not? And do you believe the idea that's been pushed that some owners don't want a season?
Yeah, I mean, I believe there's probably an owner or two that is willing to give up the season. Look at what Oakland's done with its players. I would guess Oakland probably would be in favor of that. They run a very, very tight ship, shall we say, and I think tight is a nice word there. You know, they have not just released the players. They've actually are not paying the players while keeping them on the payroll, which they get nothing of. So, I mean, they are eligible to do that. To me, that's terrible. Now, a couple of the players are saying, well, we still get benefits, so it's better than being released. But I just think that's unfair. That's one of the, in the contract, minor league contract, they can do whatever they want. So, I believe that there's Oakland and maybe a couple other teams, but it takes eight teams to not ratify an agreement. Are there eight teams that are really not interested in the season? I don't believe that. So putting that aside, you know, Scott Boras took aim at the Yankees. They were upset. They disputed some of the things that were said in his letter to his players. Some of the other teams were not thrilled with different things that he said, but I would say the best point for the player side and Mr. Boras to make is that the owners have made a lot of money. And when I say that, I exclude Miami. Miami lost money last year. I do believe that, according to Forbes, and I think that's right. Kansas City, which has handled things magnificently, has a new owner, so he has not made any profit yet, and he bought at the wrong time. So he's going to be taking a loss, at least in the short term. But I do believe the other teams have made money, and not only that, the franchises have gone up in some cases many fold. Let's not forget Arnie Moreno bought the Angels for something like $200 million. Milwaukee was bought for $150 million. Baltimore, Cleveland also in that range, $150 million. These teams are all, despite the fact that the values have probably gone down this year, they're all worth $1 billion plus. The Angels case $2 billion plus. I do generally agree with the players in saying that you can't privatize the gains and then socialize the losses. And what that means is, you know, every year you make big gains, you don't then share the extra gains with the players, and then you have one terrible year. And I think the owners will lose money this year, however it goes, whether they play or don't play, whatever deals come to, they are going to lose money. But you can't then just say, I've made money for 17 straight years or however many years and everything's been great, and now we have a bad year and the players need to share in the losses. So I think that is a overall general good argument for the players. As to the specifics of the Cubs, the Yankees, and all these other things, you know, obviously Scott Boras isn't privy to all of the information. The books are not open. He may be wrong on some points, but generally speaking, the Cubs have made a windfall with that investment. And, you know, I mean, they took the chance. They are the entrepreneur. There's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, this year they're going to take a loss, and, you know, they're going to have to accept taking a loss.
John, obviously we're focused on the negotiations, but meanwhile in baseball, you have 1,200 minor leaguers around there that have been released, and maybe a lot of them would have been released anyway, but there are some of them that might have you know, been eventual major leaguers. I mean, you can't tell a guy like David Bote that when he was coming up that he wouldn't have been among the group that would have been released now. There might be guys out there like that who were late bloomers. So the question, I guess, is this. When you look at Major League Baseball and then you look at Minor League Baseball, the draft is now five rounds. You've got college baseball programs being cut across America. You've got now, you know, the minor league players being released for the development of those prospects, for the growth of a sport struggling to attract young people. What does this mean for the future?
Yeah, no, I work at MLB Network, so I work at MLB, but that doesn't mean I have to agree with everything that goes on. I understand the financial issues that they have. I get that. That said, I love minor league baseball. Not that I've been to a lot of games lately, but my first job was in Moline, Illinois, not too far from you guys, at 3 hours west, and I worked at the Moline Dispatch. They had a team there. It was the Quad City Cubs for a while, then the Quad City Angels. But when it was the Quad City Cubs, I mean, there were fans there that went to the games and enjoyed the games, that grew up as Cubs fans, that grew up as baseball fans. I see a value in minor league baseball. And obviously the players are not paid very much, but there is a value. It may, you know, on an individual basis, it may be small, whatever. I don't really agree with the plan to cut 42 teams. You know, and at this point, with the teams cut, the season extremely unlikely. I don't see any reason that there's going to be a minor league season when you have the health concerns and, you know, their revenue is all made through fans going to the games. There's no TV for the minor league for the most part. No TV money, so their season is going to be cut. So I do get cutting some players. It just feels like you're right. I think the Bote example is excellent. There are going to be some players out of that 1,200 or so that are cut that could have made, or, you know, we'll see what happens here, but have a chance to have made the major leagues. Now, I don't – what is percentage is that? I think it's tiny. I mean, the MLB teams know which teams are prospects. But out of 1,200, I would bet, and I almost guarantee there's one or two or maybe 10 that could have made the major league. So I find it sad from two aspects there. So I don't love it. I love what the Royals did. They didn't cut anybody. They're paying everybody the stipend, or in the case of the Class A players, a little bit less what they would have been paid anyway. They're taking a hit there. It's not going to be a crazy hit. It's going to be a couple $100,000, but good for them for doing it. Nobody else is doing it. So I don't love that whole thing. I don't love it. I do get it from a business perspective. Seriously, 98% or more of these players are not going to be major league players. But you're very good to come up with one example there. That is a guy who was an extremely late bloomer who made it. And there are others like that. I'm hopeful, and I've heard that maybe these players are going to start their own independent league and
yeah. And
enjoy baseball in Arizona or Florida in the fall. Hopefully the health data allows it, and maybe we'll see one Cinderella story like that or two Cinderella stories, but it's sad to see all these dreams die en masse. Not really very sad, I think.
I mean, I think it's awful for the game, John, also because, you know, these are teachers, people who learn the game at a young age and play it for as long as these guys do, are then having kids and teaching the game. And, you know, it's just bad for the sport to lose players, to lose, you know, that potential of spreading the kind of gospel of baseball everywhere.
Absolutely right. You know, not many of those players are David Bote or people like that who can make major league careers out of what seemed like no chance, certainly several of them are the type that would be good coaches, good teachers, could hang around this game, could make careers for themselves as coaches, front office, other things. Now their network is cut off completely, and that is also unfortunate. To me, for this small savings, it's just not worth it, I don't think.
That is John Heyman, Radio.com Sports MLB Insider with Mully and Haugh, giving you a pretty comprehensive look at where baseball stands right now on all of those issues. We are going to do the Midday Midway today. I have a story of a former professional star athlete who has been ruled by a judge, has been deemed to be such an irretrievable scumbag that it is literally, legally impossible to defame him. We also have a winner in Tiger King. Another shoe has dropped here. If you followed Tiger King at all, and that bat spit crazy series of, what was it, seven or eight episodes of the people that own big cats and the rivalries within, we just had a judge rule in a case there that may kind of bring an end to it, ultimately, after all. And now, look, if you want a tiger or a liger or something, you're going to be able to get one, because I think there are going to be some on the market right now. All that and more coming up on the Midday Midway. It is next on The Score.
The first half or the second half, you know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel it.
The Midday Midway with Dan Bernstein on The Score.
We're at the Midday Midway of this show, and we started out by praising George H. McCaskey, the chairman of the Chicago Bears, for the statement that he put out. It was his statement, it was the Bears' statement, and it was really, really well done. As these teams are rolling these out, some are more lukewarm than others, some are more disingenuous than others. His was not. He used all the right words and identified the right things and didn't water down what is causing the anger and the disruption and the fear right now in our country. He didn't water it down. He didn't shy from it. So kudos to George McCaskey and the Bears for doing what they did and the way that they did it. Not so much the Cubs. Their statement left a lot to be desired and in some ways seemed a bit both sidesy for my tastes. We also talked about what happened with Pete Ricketts and the meeting that he had with black leadership in Omaha, where he was roundly criticized by referring to them as you people, saying the problem I have with you people, and the anger in Omaha is continuing to increase rather than decrease because of the behavior. And frankly, it's a racist comment coming from the governor of Nebraska, who is also technically, sort of nominally, part of Cubs ownership as well. We also played for you the Dabo Swinney word salad of whatever the hell he's talking about, basically saying that God wants him to have the best recruiting class as possible, and because the devil is here, that there's always going to be racism. So it was a way of boiling down all through his phony baloney religious gobbledygook to say black lives matter to me when they help me make millions and millions of dollars. But, you know, down there, maybe that plays. Dave Zirin joined us as well. Oh, we heard from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar on CBS. Dave Zirin talked about his conversation with Greg Popovich and other things. And then you heard from John Heyman on the latest what's going on with baseball. A judge has dismissed Lenny Dykstra's defamation lawsuit against former New York Mets teammate Ron Darling, ruling the outfielder's reputation was already so tarnished it could not be damaged more. This is just impeccable logic here. Dykstra claimed he was defamed when Darling alleged he had made racist remarks toward Boston pitcher Oil Can Boyd during the 1986 World Series. Justice Robert D. Kalish in New York Supreme Court in Manhattan did not evaluate whether the remarks occurred. His quote, "It is only to say that Dykstra's reputation for unsportsmanlike conduct and bigotry is already so tarnished that it cannot be further injured by the reference, Kaler said in a decision issued on Friday. Dykstra filed the suit in April of 2019 against Darling, St. Martin's Press, and Macmillan Publishing Group, then added Daniel Paisner as a defendant last September. Dykstra's suit followed the publication of Darling's book, 108 Stitches, Loose Threads, Ripping Yarns, and the Darndest Characters from My Time in the Game. And it's by St. Martin's Press, part of Macmillan. Dykstra alleged defamation and intentional infliction of emotional distress. Darling wrote that Dykstra was, quote, one of baseball's all-time thugs, and was in the on-deck circle at Boston's Fenway Park before Game 3 of the 1986 World Series while Boyd warmed up and was shouting every imaginable and unimaginable insult and expletive in his direction. Foul, racist, hateful, hurtful stuff. Darling called it, quote, one of the worst collection of taunts and insults I'd ever heard. Worse, I'm betting, than anything Jackie Robinson might have heard his first couple of times around the league. Dykstra was sentenced 8 years ago to prison on both federal and California state charges. This from the judge's ruling. Based on the papers submitted on this motion, prior to the publication of the book, Dykstra was infamous for being, among other things, racist, misogynist, and anti-gay, as well as a sexual predator, a drug abuser, a thief, and an embezzler. Muggers, buggers, bushwhackers. The nature and seriousness of Dykstra's criminal offenses, which include fraud, embezzlement, grand theft, lewd conduct, and assault with a deadly weapon, and notably the degree of publicity they received, have already established his general bad reputation for fairness and decency, far worse than the alleged racially charged bench jockeying in the reference could, the judge wrote. He dismissed the second count as duplicating the defamation allegation. He also said, given Dykstra's celebrity and apparent attraction to the spotlight, Dykstra's remedy lies in telling his own story to the public. And he concludes, the court sees no legal basis for why it should use its very limited time and resources litigating whether Dykstra engaged in yet another example of bigoted behavior over 33 years ago in a court of law. There are sports commentators, bloggers, and legions of baseball fans to litigate this issue in a public space. This court, however, has cases involving lost livelihoods, damage, and lost lives, as well as plaintiffs that have suffered very real reputational injuries. That is what you call a slapdown. And certainly deserved. We have discussed Tiger King at length in this place, on these airwaves, this show, other shows, under various iterations. Patrick Manley, of course, was our self-professed, our purported Tiger King expert who just decided he was going to book himself on the show and talk about it. Maybe we should have him back on because we've got some conclusion here. I don't know how carefully you watch, but you knew that Joe Schreibvogel, a.k.a. Joe Exotic, was going through all sorts of legal chicanery to try to hide his zoo and make sure it stayed in his family, using the resources of his parents, eventually his mother, to try to keep from having to pay Carol Baskin in the $1 million trademark judgment. Well, guess what? A federal judge.
Hello, you cool cats and kittens.
Hello. A federal judge has granted Carol Baskin's Big Cat Rescue control of imprisoned reality TV star Joe Exotic's former zoo properties in Oklahoma. She's got him now. They found that they were fraudulently transferred to avoid paying her a $1 million trademark judgment. U.S. District Judge Scott Polk in Oklahoma City ruled that Tampa-based Big Cat Rescue has sufficiently traced funds to allow for the imposition of a constructive trust under state law regarding the 16.4-acre Wynwood property formerly owned by Joseph Allen Maldonado Passage, a.k.a. Joe Exotic, who began as Joe Schreibvogel before all the other names. The order states Big Cat Rescue's constructive trust and equitable lien in and to the buildings shall survive any physical or title transfer of the building, shall follow any proceeds, except as to a good faith purchased for value. Big Cat Rescue sued Exotic's mother, Shirley Schreibvogel, in 2016, claiming fraudulent transfer of the property. Schreibvogel later admitted, under oath, that the zoo land was transferred to her by Joe Maldonado to remove it from the reach of creditors. That was according to the complaint. And Big Cat Rescue was also awarded control of several cars and cabins on the property. Judge Polk further ordered the defendants to require their current zoo operator tenant to leave within 120 days and remove all the zoo animals on the property. And I forgot the guy's name, but that's the weirdo from Las Vegas, right? The guy that wears like six jackets at a time. You know, he's got that sort of that plastic girlfriend or wife and some other, like a third companion as part of the open marriage that he's got. And then he always has multiple do-rags and several hats. I think he's the guy in charge of it. Baskin and Exotic became household names in March when Tiger King debuted. God, that seems like years ago. The show followed the eccentric personalities in the big cat enthusiast community, centering on Exotic and his feud with Baskin that resulted in an Oklahoma federal jury convicting him in 2019 of trying to hire a hitman to murder her. Yeah, and pointing out that she probably kind of killed her first husband. But that's not important right now and not why you called. Jurors only needed a few hours to convict Exotic on 2 counts of murder for hire, 8 counts of violating the Lacey Act for falsifying wildlife records, 9 counts of violating the Endangered Species Act. Prosecutors said Exotic tried to have Baskin killed, and he offered undercover federal agents $10,000 to do the job. And serving as his own attorney while behind bars, Exotic filed a $93 million lawsuit against several federal agencies he claims are in a vast conspiracy to take his animals away from him. And the animals are going to have to be taken away from him because the part of the order is that the animals have to go somewhere. Remove all the zoo animals on the property. So where do they go? I don't know if she has room for them at Big Cat Rescue or if she even wants them at Big Cat Rescue. Are they going to be euthanized? Are they going to find zoos somewhere? That's what's hanging in the balance right here. It's my hope that a lot of those perfectly innocent animals are able to find a place to go, because there were all sorts of rumors that he himself, when he was, if you watch the show, you know, the money was in the adorable little cubs, and that's where he could bring them to schools and have people play with them and cuddle with them. And when they got big, when they were eating thousands of dollars worth of meat per week, he was better off not having them. And there were reports that he was shooting them because those are the ones that he didn't want when the money was in breeding all the little and adorable ones. And when they get not so adorable and more expensive, it wasn't part of his business model. And that is our midday midway. And the 708 says, that's a bandana, sir. Don't besmirch the do-rag's name. No, but I'm telling you, that guy, the weird Vegas guy, the weird Vegas playboy guy, he always had, you're in the hot sun in Oklahoma, out there walking around trying to run a zoo, and he had like these weird skinny jeans on, and then a shirt, and then another shirt, and then a jacket, and then another jacket, and then a bandana and a hat, and like a hat over the hat. I don't get that. I'm not sure what purpose that serves, but, you know, okay. 309 says, just release
that works for you, Dan. You got to stick with it. You got to stick. If you find it, it's like the kids that wear the wool caps even in the middle of summer.
Right.
I look good in a wool cap, so I'm wearing it all year round, damn it. You got to find your summer and winter looks.
Or is
that's
that
my
like
advice as a fashionista.
Short sleeve t-shirt over the long sleeve t-shirt?
Yes. Yeah. That's I like that look, actually. It's a good one. Because then if you get too hot, you could take off the long sleeve one and there you go.
No, you can't, because that's underneath. That's what I never understood.
Well, you can take your shirt off.
I guess you could.
If you have
but
a car and you go hide.
That look
forest.
Is for really skinny people. The t-shirt look and sometimes the knit cap look, that's for skinny skater boys, I think. Most people can't pull that off. What's the Jerry Seinfeld belief? He's like, it's when you get married or there's a certain point where you lock in your look, where it just, and I always thought it was getting married, because once you're married, it doesn't matter anymore, really. It's over.
Yeah, that's probably true. One time in my life, I heard a description like, oh, he's a t-shirt and jeans kind of guy. And I'm like, that sounds good. I'll be that person. That's going to be my look.
Yeah, I don't mind the cargo shorts and t-shirt look.
Because yeah, you're just a free shirt and plastic pants kind of guy.
Yes, I am. Whatever t-shirt was given to me for free, Adidas sweatpants, that's winter. And perhaps a hoodie, and then summer is t-shirt and cargo shorts, and that's pretty much, I'm pretty much good in that regard. And Jeff Lowe, that's the guy's name. Thank you, 815 texter. You rarely hear me say thank you, 815 texter, but thank you. Yes, Jeff Lowe.
These are strange times.
We live in unprecedented times when Bernstein is spanking a texter from the 815. But that was the Midday Midway. And coming up next, we are going to talk with Mark Lazarus. We can talk to him about what Jonathan Toews said, talk to him about what is happening in hockey. That's a sport that is in a little different place when it comes to its athletes and an understanding of racial sensitivity. They're coming from a little different place in that regard. So we'll talk about all of that next with him on The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.